Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. We have a very large audience today. I think I say that every week, but in fact, today our audience is terrific. So I'm going to introduce the JPC and our work, and then introduce our speaker. If you've heard the introduction before, hear it again. Jewish Policy Center is a 501c3 nonprofit organization established in 1985, providing analysis of foreign and domestic policy. We support a strong American defense capability, missile defense, and U.S.-Israel security cooperation. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And right now, we support, more than anything, the government of Israel in its quest to secure the border and the people of Israel and force the return of the hostages, because it's become clear that negotiating a ceasefire only provides Hamas and Hezbollah more time for terrorism and destruction, and we are not interested. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. You can read our publications, Insight articles, In Context blog, and our magazine In Focus Quarterly on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. You can also find our previous webinars. There is a lot of good information there and a lot of very enlightening speakers. Speaking of enlightening speakers, I am thrilled to have Jonathan Shanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, as our guest today. John previously worked as a terrorism finance analyst at the Department of the Treasury, where he played an integral role in the designation of numerous terrorist financiers. He has spent time at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and at Middle East Forum, and he sat in my chair here at the Jewish Policy Center. John, I hope I can live up to your standard. He is the author of a number of books, one of which is called Gaza 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War. The rocket war of 2021 seems like a very long time ago, but it's a reminder that the conflict then ended in a ceasefire that Hamas broke on October 7th. His previous books have also made important contributions in the field: State of Failure, Yasser Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas, and the Unmaking of the Palestinian State argues that the main roadblock to Palestinian statehood is the Palestinian Authority, its political dysfunction, and its mismanagement. And no one I know argues the other side. Hamas versus Fatah is one of his books, The Struggle for Palestine. It analyzes the ongoing Palestinian civil war. And I think at this point, that has only become more relevant to the conversation. And Al-Qaeda's armies, Middle East affiliate groups, and the next generation of terror. John has written hundreds of articles on the Middle East, along with more than a dozen monographs and chapters for edited volumes. He testifies before Congress, which needs his input, and publishes in the American and international media everywhere you think he would and should. A much sought-after speaker, he has traveled widely throughout the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE, Iraq, Yemen, Egypt, Morocco, Kuwait, Qatar, Turkey, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. Anything you want to add to that, Jonathan? He earned his PhD from King's College in London, where he wrote his dissertation on the U.S. Congress and its efforts to combat terrorism. Maybe he'll tell you how well Congress is doing, and maybe he'll tell you how well Israel is doing, and maybe he'll tell you what the region looks like. Jonathan Shanzer, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. Great to be with you. Great to be with everyone here on their lunch break, I'm assuming. When Shoshana and I agreed that I would do this this discussion, it was before we learned about Yahya Sinwar. It was with the expectation that we were going to see an imminent Israeli strike on Iran in response to those 181 ballistic missiles from earlier this month. A lot of surprises. The Israelis have yet to strike. Sinwar is now gone. We're in a new place. It seems like every week there's just a new reality that we wake up to. So what I thought I'd do is just go around the region and look front by front at the seven front war that Israel is waging. I think actually that war is probably even more fronts than seven, and we'll talk about that as well. The plan is, of course, to do what Shoshana always asks me to do. I always try to comply. And so we'll speak for about 20, 25 minutes, and then very happy to take questions that you may have. I'll start with Gaza because that's where all of this started. Obviously, the Hamas terrorist organization is on its back foot. It is really teetering on full collapse. Sinwar's death, of course, we all now know, was something of an accident. The IDF soldiers that happened upon him were not preparing to find him. This was not some kind of pinpoint intelligence operation. It was literally a number of young men, recent recruits to the IDF on patrol, and came upon some suspicious-looking armed individuals. Began to engage as IDF protocol would demand. They ended up injuring Sinwar, and then ultimately, after sending a drone into the building where he had been injured, they called in a tank strike and subsequently killed him. And only learned after who he was. What's really fascinating, by the way, about that particular incident was that at least one or perhaps even more of the soldiers involved were from the Netzach Yehuda unit within the IDF. This is a religious and nationalist unit within the IDF, and one that until recently was being considered for sanctions by the Biden administration. And this, of course, is an interesting twist because imagine that this would have been a designated unit within the IDF. That in and of itself is a very difficult thing for me to get my head wrapped around in terms of just being a former sanctions official at the US Treasury. This was never the intent, but imagine if a designated entity had actually taken out the head of Hamas, and then the US would celebrate it. Just a very odd dynamic. And I think one to watch as we continue to see the administration place sanctions on different individuals and entities, primarily in the West Bank. But at any rate, when we look now at the state of play with Hamas, this is an organization that has been eviscerated. My best back of the envelope numbers suggest that 23 out of 24 Hamas brigades have been destroyed. Roughly 18 or maybe even 19,000 Hamas terrorists have been killed. That's out of the 30,000 that were deployed at the beginning of 10/7, at the beginning of this war. There are thousands that have been injured and that are not returning to the battlefield. There are thousands that are sitting in Israeli jails and that are currently giving intelligence to their interrogators. Hamas is in bad shape. There's probably only about four or five individuals left that I could recognize that could potentially take over. Mohammed Sinwar, Yahya's brother, is, I think, at this point recognized to be the person that is running the war from the tunnels within Gaza. I would argue that he probably doesn't have a whole lot of time left, especially now that the Israelis have control of the Philadelphia corridor, that area that runs astride the Sinai Peninsula and Gaza. With the Israelis in control of that, it's very unlikely he'll be able to leave the Gaza Strip. And the Israelis continue to map out and destroy a lot of those tunnels. As I understand it, we're now up to about 15% of those tunnels being destroyed. It's a matter of time before they are all unusable, and that will force Hamas above ground. And that, of course, I think will ultimately mean the end of Mohammed Sinwar. In the meantime, there are other individuals abroad that we can potentially look at that could take on leadership roles. I'm looking at Khaled Meshaal, primarily in Qatar right now. That's an interesting one because I think the US has potential leverage to have Meshaal extradited if we had the political will to demand that of the Qataris. I'd be very happy to have Qatar chicken winged a bit to just put Khaled Meshaal on Al Jazeera, Hamas's cheerleading television station, and to have him declare the end of the war and to have him call for the release of the hostages. That alone, I think, would do a great deal to end this war. A lot of this is going to depend on American political will. I don't see a lot of it right now out of this White House, but who knows, after the election, perhaps things may change. I do think that that could bring about a more rapid end of war. There are a few other leaders that we could look to. Halil Hayya, in particular, a guy that travels back and forth between Turkey and Lebanon and Qatar. He's a guy that I would also watch as a potential leader. But I think at the end of the day, we're looking at an eviscerated Hamas, and I do think that's good news. The hard fighting in Gaza has been over for several months, and it's not likely to pick back up again anytime soon. The war's not over. There will be continued insurgencies and skirmishes, but the hard fighting's done. The hard fighting, however, is picking up on Israel's northern border. Of course, we know that the Israelis have done remarkable work over the last, let's say, 8 weeks, where they took out a lot of the Radwan forces with that exploding beeper operation, Operation Castration, as some may call it, or Operation Liver to the Knee, I've also heard. That was extraordinary. And the Israelis had developed that capability for years. And held it until it was almost discovered. Then they deployed the same technology to explode some walkie-talkies. Then they took out the Secretary of General of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah. They were able to take out Fuad Shukr before him. A number of senior leaders have been killed. Hezbollah is in bad shape, and that is, I think, for one key reason, and that is that Israel had developed a lot of these capabilities over the years and had not used them. Compare that to the regular cadence of the fighting that we saw in Gaza, where the Israelis were using a lot of their capabilities more quickly, right? They were able to save up enough of these with Hezbollah that I think they could have a real impact. And what that's done here, just to make sure everybody understands the achievement. There was, I think, an assessment early on in this war, and I gotta say, this kept me up at night, that Hezbollah would be able to fire 2 or 3 or 4 thousand rockets a day in Israel. You would see a massive amount of damage. You would see huge numbers of casualties. By taking out Hezbollah assets the way that the Israelis did, disrupting their command and control, eliminating a lot of their leaders, destroying a massive amount of their short and medium-term capabilities, those rockets, that it was something like 200,000 rockets that had been stored and ready for this war. A lot of those capabilities and a lot of those individuals are now no longer. That means that what we're seeing is something like 200 or 300 rockets per day. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is there's still 200 or 300 rockets per day. That means that Israel is taking a huge amount of damage on its northern border. It means that there are still casualties, there are still injuries. They're going to continue to happen. I saw a video this morning of some kind of precision-guided munition that appears to have potentially taken out 8 Israeli soldiers and several vehicles. We continue to see horrific things in the north. The Israelis continue to try to erode Hezbollah's capabilities. They will not get all of it. And so ultimately, the Israelis are still looking for some kind of diplomatic solution to this crisis. And they've made their demands fairly clear that they need Hezbollah to withdraw north of the Litani River. This is, of course, enshrined in UN Security Council Resolution 1701. That needs to happen, and there needs to be a waving of the white flag of sorts from Hezbollah in order for the fighting to stop. I think the Israelis did something very interesting yesterday by announcing that there was a massive amount of money and gold sitting beneath one of the primary hospitals in the Dahiya area. This is also where Nasrallah's bunkers had been. That's an interesting strategy slash tactic that the Israelis are, I think, trying to push the Lebanese citizens who are already tired of Hezbollah and don't want to see this war devolve into something that would be far more chaotic or destructive. They're actually trying to encourage the Lebanese people to turn against Hezbollah. That would be a wonderful development. I don't know whether it's likely or not, but I do think that this is the same tactic that they've used with the Iranians, and I'll speak about that momentarily. They want to turn the people against the regime there as well. This is the right strategy to take. I will just note, by the way, that the hospital that has been identified by the IDF spokesperson's office is one of a network of other hospitals that may need to be struck if in fact this war evolves and devolves into the slugfest that I still fear could be the case. We've not yet seen some of Hezbollah's long-range missiles and precision missiles deployed. It's been mostly short-range missiles, short-range rockets, and drones. If that changes, the tone of the war will change, and that's something to watch. And then the Israelis will have to go after more hardened targets and perhaps some that exist below civilian infrastructure in tunnel systems below ground. So that's something to watch. But in the meantime, the Israelis have thwarted a possible ground invasion, even though Hezbollah continues to threaten to take Israeli hostages. As we understand it, most, if not all, of the tunnels have been destroyed. The Israelis are doing good work. But again, we need to be very clear here that this war is going to continue and it could get worse before it gets better. Now on to Iran. Of course, we know about the 181 ballistic missiles that Iran fired at Israel. It was the largest ballistic missile attack that we've seen, I think, in military history. The Israelis have been planning their counterstrike. That has been delayed for two different reasons, best we understand it. One is that the Biden administration has been watering down the targets. We now know that nuclear targets are off the table. We know that oil targets are off the table for very different reasons. The nuclear targets, I think there's just a lot of sensitivity about whether an attack would push Iran to make a dash for a bomb. And that's not something that the Biden administration wants as it enters into this lame duck period. The other is, of course, if the Israelis took out oil targets, that would make the price of oil skyrocket. And nobody wants that to happen if you are working for a White House in the lead up to an election. So a number of targets have been taken off the table. I would say, though, that there are still a number of targets that we can say are very viable that we should, I think, be clear about. One is the intelligence services of the Islamic Republic. They came close to hitting the Mossad in that ballistic missile strike the other day, something like, a quarter of a mile away was where one of those ballistic missiles landed. I think, one good turn probably deserves another from the Israeli perspective. I would expect ballistic missile storage to be hit to prevent additional strikes carried out by the Iranians. If the Israelis have intel on where those missiles are, they're likely to be hit. Air defense, that's a guarantee because the Israelis want to be able to go back into Iran on multiple occasions if this thing escalates. So being able to take out those Russian-made S-300s or even S-400s, I could imagine that they would be targets as well. There is a question now about leadership after the drone attack out of Lebanon, apparently ordered by the Islamic Republic, that hit the home of Benjamin Netanyahu. There is, I think, an open question whether the Israelis will try to hit the supreme leader of Iran or some of the other senior leaders of the clerical regime. But all of that, I think, has been stymied, whatever those targets are. They may have been stymied by a leak of classified information on a Telegram channel, purportedly by someone who works at the Pentagon. There are a lot of usual suspects out there, names that have been known to all of us for some time, exposed earlier this year, people that are perhaps sympathetic to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And they're the people who are kind of, if you're thinking Occam's razor, they're probably the most obvious of the people that we might point fingers at. I think it's all too soon to know exactly what happened here. Lots of rumors flying around. I think we need to wait and see and let the US government do its job. I will just say this, as someone who once held a clearance, no longer does, I can recall the fear and the concern that I had when I took that job that I would even mistakenly allow for classified information to be uttered in a conversation I was having with someone. It was something that I thought about day and night about making sure that I was careful. This is absolutely outrageous that something like this would happen. This is not something that I would suspect would result merely in someone losing their job. I would suspect jail time for something this grave and this serious. And I hope that's what happens as a result of an ODNI investigation. Just to wrap up, as I know we're getting close to my 20, 25 minute mark, I would just say we continue to watch those militias in Iraq and Syria. Those are two fronts that need to be watched. They have been largely under control after we saw a series of attacks against American servicemen. This has not been the most dangerous front for Israel, but it's been very dangerous for the United States as our troops and our bases have been attacked. That's one to watch in the immediate aftermath of whatever strikes come from Israel, because, of course, the U.S. is now briefed up in some shape or form about what the Israelis plan to strike, how they plan to strike. Of course, the Israelis may not be sharing as much now that there is clearly a breach of trust between our two countries. That will be interesting as well. The other hot front that I think we need to keep an eye on is, of course, the Houthis. You've probably seen the news that the U.S. struck some Houthi targets deep beneath the ground. And I think that was a truly positive development. The U.S. has not done enough to thwart the Houthi aggression that we've seen in the Red Sea. It's unbelievable to me that the Houthis have all but shut down the Red Sea shipping lane for as long as they have. That should have been a red line for the U.S. It is just, it's inexplicable that the U.S. has not done more to neutralize the Houthi threat. But I think there was a good message sent the other day from the administration hitting targets deep beneath the ground. I think it was a good message to the Houthis, but I think more importantly, it was a good message to the Iranians to let them see that the U.S. has that capability. Of course, the Israelis have it. They showed it when they took out Hassan Nasrallah. The problem is that it needed to drop something like 80 of those 2,000-pound bombs. Those are not easy to carry all the way to Yemen or to Iran. And so, for Israel's Air Force, that would take quite a bit of work. So to have the U.S. demonstrate its capability on that side of the Middle East was, I think, very helpful. A couple of other quick things. I do think that there should be significant pressure on the Qataris right now to try to hasten the end of the war with Gaza. I think the Qataris are the key to getting the hostages released and to getting Hamas to wave the white flag. And even if there is some difference of opinion among the political leaders based in whether it's Doha or Istanbul or Beirut, that matters little. If there's difference of opinion between the political and the military wing of Hamas, so to speak, I don't see much of a difference between them. But even if there is some of a difference between them, that doesn't matter. The Qataris should be forced to compel whoever is there in Doha to get on television and call for an end of this war. Why the U.S. has not done this with the Qataris, the so-called major non-NATO U.S. ally, this is an insane thing that they have not been held to account. We know that there are senior Hamas leaders who have influence on the rest of the group in Gaza and beyond. That influence needs to be wielded right now if the goal is to bring about an end to the war. The last thing that I'll just point out is I think there are two fronts that we need to keep a close eye on. These are allies of Israel, allies of the United States that have become a danger. I don't want to say that they pose a direct threat to Israel, but the countries of Jordan and Egypt worry me very much at this moment. And I think these are like, I don't know, black swan type files that we need to keep an eye on. With the Egyptians, I was very concerned about the tunnels going from the Sinai Peninsula into Gaza. At one point, we were hearing about the existence of hundreds of these tunnels that were supplying Hamas, according to reports. After the Israelis took over these tunnels, it seemed like the number of tunnels kept going down. Once the Israelis took Philadelphia, it seemed like we went from 200 to 150 to 100 to 75. And at the end, the Israelis declared that there were, I think, nine tunnels that were not currently operational. I'm not sure what that means, but it seems like there was some kind of a negotiation about how much Egypt was held to account for whatever malfeasance we might point to. I think the Egyptians have a lot of explaining to do. They've just changed out their head of intelligence. And I don't know if that was a sign to the US or to Israel that a change was being made. But even yesterday, or maybe it was the day before, there was a drone that carried weapons from Sinai into Gaza that was shot down by the Israelis. I keep a very close eye on that border. I think it's an extremely dangerous and volatile place. And the government of Egypt does not seem to want to take any responsibility for what's happened. That worries me as well. And of course, they had even threatened to abrogate the Camp David Accords if Israel had taken the Philadelphia Corridor. In the end, It ended up passing without a lot of drama, but I do think that the Israelis do need to stay there. And I do think that there does need to be a serious conversation, a trilateral conversation between Egypt, Israel, and the United States about the future of the relationship. Taxpayer dollars are at stake. The security of the Middle East is at stake. Finally, Jordan. Jordan is an interesting place to watch because the rhetoric coming out of this U.S. ally and this Israeli peace partner has been nothing short of vitriolic. This is, of course, due to the fact that in Jordan, it's roughly 80 to 85% Palestinian population there. The government of Jordan will not admit to this, but we know that the demographics don't lie. And the Jordanians sound almost indistinguishable from the Iranian regime in the way that they talk about Israel, in the way that they vilify Israel. That has to stop. In the meantime, what we're seeing is actually a huge amount of weapons, cash, and even people being smuggled across the border from Syria, through the Shiite militias that are based there. They are trying to destabilize the Hashemite kingdom, and a lot of that cash and weapons, that's flowing into the West Bank because the border security is not great between Israel and Jordan. Now, a lot of people said, well, why doesn't Israel just build a better border, just like they did in Gaza? Well, if Israel does that, it will very likely anger any number of constituents. The first will be the Jordanians, who are going to say, you're making a permanent border. And if it's not exactly where the internationally recognized borders are, then the Jordanians will be unhappy. If the Israelis adhere to that, well, then you have a settler population of roughly 400,000 people or more that will be furious that Israel's not changing the borders in some shape or form to account for their desires and needs. And this doesn't even get to the questions revolving around the Palestinians themselves. So the Israelis are stuck between a rock and a hard place there. But the bottom line is that Jordan has a capacity problem. It's got a rhetoric problem. And all in all, when we look across the region right now, we see a lot of volatility. I didn't even get to the West Bank, where, of course, the IDF has been operating there just about every night, tackling the terror groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad and even the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. So we've got a lot of instability still. On seven hot fronts and two lukewarm fronts. And we've got the Qataris to contend with. We've got the Turks that we need to deal with, who are as bad as the Qataris in terms of being sponsors of Hamas. So a lot of questions that still are yet to be answered. The good news, though, is I think that one front appears to be winding down. Then we've got the day after, that's in Gaza. I think Israel's got the upper hand in Lebanon. And hopefully, we'll see the US try to use some of this as leverage to negotiate a soft landing to this conflict. It would be, I think, a welcome development to see this conflict end. It's been costly to Israel, both in terms of lives and in terms of damage and in terms of the financial cost to Israel. I think we probably are likely still going to see several months of fighting. And during the lame duck, who knows? Maybe Israel finds itself pushing further on the offensive, given that there may be fewer restrictions, but I guess we can possibly argue that. Shoshana and I were having that discussion before I came on. I'll leave it there, and I'm very happy to answer any questions you have. Hopefully, we've gone around the horn enough to give you a sense of the complexity of the seven front plus war.
Jonathan Shanzer, thank you. As always, a great view of the region. I feel like we've gone, 12,000 miles around, and for each mile we have covered, there is a question. So I'm going to try to winnow through the questions. And the first is a general question about the U.S. How would you assess the overall administration's attitude toward Israel in this war? They go from approving some things and applauding some things. I mean, they really had no choice but to applaud the passing of the guys who were responsible for the Marine barracks bombing. But then they also do these other things, like telling Israel, you can't do this and you can't do that. If you had to give them an overall grade, recognizing that Anthony Blinken is there now on his 16th visit since October 7th, what's the grade?
It's a C.
Ally, not ally.
Yeah,
It's a
it's
C.
a C. And the reason why is that there have been a weeks, a months, a days, right, where they're truly Excellent. And then other days that are just abject failures, Fs. And when you average them out, you're going to get a C. And it's but by the way, I mean, when you fail as bad as this administration has on certain fronts, it really does shake the confidence. And so C doesn't necessarily capture the full picture here. It's almost bipolar what we're watching, right? An administration that gives full support to Israel early on, and directs Israel to fight the war in Gaza. Then once Israel starts fighting the war in Gaza, Israel is told not to fight during the entire month of Ramadan. Then is told that it cannot advance on Rafah because of humanitarian concerns that actually never materialized. You see the administration withholding weapons and still withholding some of those 2,000-pound bombs, as we understand it right now, which is just really hard to imagine. I think the problem has been, I mean, it's twofold. One is, of course, politics have weighed heavily on this. I think Biden initially, when he lent his support to Israel, the political situation was not as acute. But as his left flank, as the woke left, if you will, the progressive left of the Democratic Party began to weigh in more and more on the war, Biden began to fear voter turnout. He began to fear dissension within the ranks. And I think that clearly changed some of his thinking and changed the trajectory of the war. The other part of this was, I think, just the myopic focus on Gaza, right? That was the primary front of the war for as long as the US could continue to force it to be. I think what's interesting now is, after the death of Sinwar, as we continue to watch what's going on in Lebanon, as a possible escalation looms in between Iran and Israel, what we now see is that this has always been an Iran-led war. It's the axis of, they call themselves resistance. I think we should be honest here and say it's an axis of aggressors. They are waging this war, and as long as we can widen out that aperture, as long as we see it for what it is, I think we can begin to understand that this was never about the Palestinians. And when the administration tried to keep it focused on the Palestinians, it was a huge mistake. The question that I ask now is, how much latitude does the Israeli government get? How much latitude does the IDF get heading into this, 2.5, 3 month period between the elections and inauguration? And then how much latitude do the Israelis get after that? I think a big question we have to ask ourselves right now, and this is, I think, I'll broaden it out just a little bit more, is how much latitude do they get from the incoming president? Will Kamala Harris try to shut down the war right away because of her wanting to be responsive to that progressive element of the Democratic Party, knowing that it's not popular among certain core people within her party, within her constituents? Does Trump extend this and allow for the Israelis to finish what they started? Or does he, as he's talked about, make deals and try to emphasize diplomacy? I'm not sure that diplomacy works right now without a lot of leverage. Maybe Trump's personality itself, maybe his reputation as the guy that killed Qasem Soleimani, maybe that helps. I don't know. But there are a lot of unknowns here as we begin to sort of wrap up the Biden administration with its bipolar approach. Leaves a lot, almost too much room for, for the delta between these two policies. There's a lot of places in between that I don't like. I'd like to see that full-throated support that enables Israel to win. I think that's the kind of thing that shores up fear in the region of the US-led world order and begins to reestablish the sort of status quo ante the way that it should.
Let's open that aperture a little bit farther. You mentioned Jordan and you mentioned the problems that Jordan's having. It seems to me also that the West Bank problems are both generated by Iran also. So one of the things that motivates Jordan, in my opinion, is the king's fear that he will be overthrown because he is a minority king. And it would enhance the, what do they call that, the ring of aggression or the ring of
Ring of
fire
Fire.
that Iran's ring of fire. If you had Jordan and the West Bank under control of Hamas, preferably, but Hamas-ish kinds of people. I remember being in Jordan a long time ago, maybe 2011, with a group of American military officers, and the Jordanian security forces told us that their weapons pointed inward in Jordan, and everyone went, huh, what? And he explained the Syrians were trying to send weapons down through Syria into Jordan to go over to the West Bank and stir up more trouble on the West Bank for Israel. And their job was not to let that happen because they didn't want the Iranians to have that kind of control. I think that's gone now. I think we're finished with that. So, is Iran also the generator of the Israel-Jordan rift and potentially, and I'm going to get to Palestinians in a little while in PA, and a Palestinian-Israeli widening of the rift?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at how I mentioned the drugs and the fighters and the guns and the explosives that are coming into Jordan, they're coming by way of Syria. They're coming by way of Shia militias that have, essentially they're trying to sell Captagon. They're trying to distribute Captagon in Jordan, but also beyond. Jordan's kind of a way station for the smuggling operations. There's weapons that are coming in, occasionally fighters that are coming in. Some of the weapons are being dropped by drone. Some, we're just seeing incursions across the border. This is a hugely destabilizing process here that I'm describing. It used to be that, by the way, the Captagon used to be smuggled onward to the Gulf where they could get $20 a pill. They can't get that. That's not the market price in Jordan, which is a far, poorer country. And people are spending $5 on these pills, and the smugglers are keeping them there anyway as a means to erode the social fabric of Jordan. And in the meantime, I mean, they continue to encourage the kind of radical rhetoric that we see in Jordan. They've been trying to sort of stoke the ire of the Palestinian majority population in Jordan. And then there's all this border activity. And by the way, you'll probably recall we've seen a couple of attacks, I think two so far since the war began, of someone coming across from Jordan, one Jordanian national and one Turkish national, but actually using this border to carry out attacks against Israelis. This whole thing is highly destabilizing. Again, the Israelis cannot produce. They cannot put up a fence in the West Bank in particular because of the fears of what it would do politically. So the instability continues. This is absolutely driven by the Islamic Republic. They would love nothing more than to see Jordan go the way of Syria or Lebanon or some of these other places that have succumbed to Iranian militia or Iranian influence. That's what's happened in each of these countries, and they're now essentially hollowed out, and they're territories through which Iran is waging its proxy war against Israel. We don't want that to happen to Jordan. Let's be very clear here. This is a regime that needs to be safeguarded. The problem is, and this is such an interesting debate in Washington right now, when I come out and criticize the Jordanians, which I've been doing since before the war, because I think the rhetoric has been so unhelpful. And the fact that they've not joined the Abraham Accords, they've not been taking part in a lot of these structures that were created, it's highly problematic. It sends the wrong message. And I think it's destabilizing. We need to be able to criticize the regime while also giving it the support that it needs. And it's a very hard thing for people to get their heads wrapped around. It's one of those sort of Middle East nuances where you can be really furious with a regime for what it's doing, but also want to safeguard it and to make sure that it does not get toppled by the wrong or the worst people. Let's put it that way.
So loop in Egypt. Egypt is also threatened by the same instability, the same Islamic radicalism. There's being Muslim Brotherhood, Sunnis. They know that. Jordan knows what its problems are. Everybody knows what the Palestinians know what their problems are. The Abraham Accords countries decided to go in a different direction to defend themselves from the threat of Iran. Don't you think that the Jordanians and the Egyptians and the Palestinians should be joining the Abraham Accords precisely because they don't want to be Syria and they don't want to be Lebanon. And I know what the pressures are, I see what the pressures are, and I agree with you completely. But they're playing both ends here, and I think it's dangerous for them, not to mention it doesn't help. Israel, and I'm going to go to a question about Palestinians and Lebanese. Maybe I'll just go to the question right now, Palestinians and Lebanese. We always talk about people who want to be freed from the radicals that hurt them. There's no question that Hezbollah has decimated Lebanon. Even before this war, they had broken it economically. Hezbollah has ruined a lot of Palestinian lives. All of this stuff is true. So Daniel Hagari tells the Lebanese people where the money is in that thing yesterday. He told them where the entrance was in the hospital, how to get down to where the bunker is with the money, and where the exit to the bunker is. He told them everything. So you think they're going to go for it? Or are these people going to stand up for themselves at any point? Or is this hopeless for Israel? The Jordanians are going to cower, and the Palestinians are going to say it's not us. And the PA says, even though they eulogized Sinwar in really disgusting ways, and the PA says, well, we should take over. And Anthony Blinken thinks they're right.
So a
Are
lot of
they ever going to
questions.
do it?
Yeah, a lot of questions wrapped up in a question.
Yes.
Let me try to unpack this. I mean, first, let's just take a look at where the Gulfies are and maybe even the Moroccans. Look, it's no secret. These are countries that are not exactly profiles in courage. They are waiting to see what happens with the war before they make decisions about, the Saudis, before they decide to push their chips in. They need to make sure that Israel's strong, that the alliance with the United States is strong, that this is the structure that's going to be running the Middle East. The last thing they want to do is make an early bet and lose. And I think even though the UAE and Morocco, they've been quiet, they've not abrogated the accords, the Bahrainis haven't either. That's all good, but it's not like the Israelis are getting these attaboys every day, like way to go, way, really happy you did that to Hamas yesterday. Some people you'll hear it, in drips and drabs, but really this has not been full-throated support. It's been quiet, and status quo, and that's good. When you look at the Jordanians and the Egyptians, the problem is that their leadership, the rhetoric, the people to people, it's been very negative for a very long time, and it's hard to change that culture. In fact, it's harder when you're seeing terrible images being broadcast on your television screen by Al Jazeera. It's very hard to roll that back. And so when you have these relatively unstable countries in bad economic shape, the last thing that the leaders are going to do is to get up and say, hey, people, you guys got it all wrong. Israel's the good guy here. We need to back them. It's never going to happen. And so they're waiting to see. I do think, though, that if Israel comes out of this war in one piece, and again, so far so good, it's been exhausting, it's been grueling, and there's been a lot of damage and loss of life and loss of income. But if they come out of this in one piece, it does set things up for a reconstructed regional order. And maybe there's more leverage to wield as it relates to the Egyptians and or the Jordanians or some of these other countries that have been sort of fence sitting while running their mouths. Now, as for the Lebanese, look, we have a very, as I see it, unorganized opposition. Even if there is an opposition at all, you have what my former colleague Tony Badran used to call this sort of Beirut coffee set, the cafe set. Right, they're against Hezbollah, but they're not mobilizing. They're not interested in mobilizing, and so it seems unlikely. Now, are there small groups or even larger groups that might be motivated to try to take some of the wealth that Hezbollah has amassed? You got to remember, Lebanon is in terrible economic shape, and I think this is the brilliance of what Hagari did the other day. Right, the currency has collapsed. The debt in Lebanon is somewhere north of $200 billion. We don't even know what the debt is. And this is a country of 5 million people with virtually no exports and no GDP to speak of. It is just, it is, yeah, it's in the toilet. The country's economy is just, it's in tatters. And so to point this out to the Lebanese people and to appeal to them at this very basic level that, hey, you can get your money back. I think there's something brilliant to it. Now, whether that leads to action, I don't know. But it's exactly the kind of thing that we should be seeing from the Israelis in terms of trying to encourage the moderates or the undecideds they could potentially take their country back, which, it's occupied, whether we want to call it that or not. Hezbollah is occupying Lebanon. Nothing happens there without Hezbollah. That's the reason why there's only been an interim government. That's why there's been friction at high levels. There's a massive amount of corruption. This is all stuff that is the direct result of Hezbollah taking charge and keeping its hands around the throat of the populace. And that actually brings me to where we are with Iran as well, because the Israeli government, Bibi himself, actually came out not too long ago with a direct address to the people of Iran, calling upon them to come out and rise up against their despotic leaders. That is really important. That's something that appears to be a very new development coming out of Israel, that they now see the downfall of the regime in Iran as something that is necessary. They see it as a policy objective, whereas before I think they would have welcomed it but never said it out loud. I think there's change here. I think that what we're seeing writ large from Israel right now is, okay, we know who the problems are, and bombing them all to oblivion is not something that the Israelis are going to be able to do. There's a finite number of weapons, and by the way, that number could be smaller if you have the wrong president with the wrong policies in place. You could see the Israelis having their weapons withheld, and to a point where it could actually put them in grave danger. So what do? If you need to be economical with your weapons, or you lack the ability to be waging war, every day for the next 20 years, you look for your secret weapons. The secret weapons are the people who are suffering, often in silence, sometimes not so silently, under the Islamic Republic itself or its proxies. This is a brilliant strategy if the Israelis can engineer it.
Okay, so now loop in some other people. We had a question here. Why are Western countries turning on Israel? I mean, you have France, the colonizer of the Levant, who should really understand how countries decolonize themselves. The UN didn't do it. But you have the UK, and you also have the United States threatening periodically, and you have a lot of Western countries who probably do understand the threat that Iran poses, and they're turning on Israel. Ireland today said they're going to stop exporting to Israel, other than Guinness. I don't know what Ireland exports to Israel. So I think they'll survive. What accounts for this sort of Western turn away from the country and the situation that could turn the Middle East into something more stable, more useful, more profitable, and better for the people?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could tell you all of the different reasons why some of these countries' governments are doing what they're doing. Some of them are motivated by sort of progressive values. Some of them are motivated by large minorities, almost majorities in their own country that are, naturalized citizens that that naturally align themselves with the Palestinians. Some are simply opposed to nationalism, by the way, and the Israelis have a fierce streak of nationalism running through them. Some are anti-war, which is ironic because Israel didn't start this war. Israel's trying to finish a war that was thrust upon it. Nevertheless, these are the sorts of things that we hear. And by the way, we also hear, different reasons from different leadership, and the logic is not always there. Right? That string of logic often is broken as they describe why they're against Israel. I think some of this is just flat out anti-Semitism. Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism in my view, and I see quite a bit of that right now. Look, I think there's some positive signs too. I mean, right now I look primarily at the East Med, and you look at Greece and Cyprus, for example, and they understand that Israel has to win this war. If they want their neighborhood, if they want the Mediterranean region to come away looking stable, right? They're looking sideways at the Turks, who are sponsors of Hamas and who are proponents of this Iran-backed war. And I mean, you may have seen, but Turkey's now been involved in a couple of different plots involving spies based in Israel. They are, of course, the sponsors of some of the worst financial criminals. Working on behalf of the Hamas terrorist organization. Some of the top leaders of Hamas have been based in Turkey. The Greeks and the Cypriots understand this. We need to, I think, be looking for more of their ilk. You see them in Eastern Europe. There have been people who've been concerned that, for example, the Hungarians are supportive of Israel, or maybe the Poles to some extent or another. There's different flavors of different countries that are still backing Israel, but I think the US's big mistake is that we've not actually assumed a leadership role in galvanizing that support. I think when the US gets wobbly, as we have been, that bipolar C grade that I mentioned, right? That is not going to inspire the international community to rally behind the United States, to rally behind Israel. That is where I think the greatest gap is right now. And it'll be interesting to see what happens again once we hit lame duck, whether we see a tone change on the part of the Biden administration, and whether we see a tone change with whatever the next administration is coming in.
So you mentioned that some of the Western Europeans are simply anti-war, among other things. And I try to imagine how anti-war they were in 1943 and why they don't get it. But okay, I'll accept. So we're going to run out of time soon, but I want to get in a couple more thoughts. We still have about 4,000 questions that you won't get to. But if you look at Gaza the day after, and let's assume that you are right, that Hamas is being decimated and that at some point Israel will be able to say the war, at least the present war, is over. Does the day after plan include Abraham Accord countries being helpful in the reconstruction and helpful in the maintenance? I know people talked about that a lot in the beginning. Is there still some hope that these guys will step up?
I think the answer is I don't know. And I'm not sure that the Gulf states know. I think that having them commit early on to the reconstruction of Gaza, where they don't get much out of it. I mean, let's just be clear. They get to spend a lot of money with an uncertain future. And if they sign up now, it looks like they're supporting Israel in a war that is yet to be decided. So they've not thrown their lot with one side or the other. Fence sitting is pretty much what the Gulf states do. I remember when the second Gulf War erupted, the second Iraq War erupted. I remember writing a piece. It was one of my first articles that I wrote when I after I moved to Washington, where I called it "Survival of the Skittish," and this was the way of describing the Gulf states. This is a skittish group of countries. They don't have a strong military. I think they wait to see who the so-called strong horse is. And I would say that that is still the case right now. And if Israel emerges as the strong horse and the US is there to back it, well, then I would say it's reasonable to assume that the Emiratis and the Saudis may get behind an effort to reconstruct Gaza. If it's less conclusive than that, you may see them sit out. And I think it'd be a shame because I do think that we have a lot of interests that align here right now. The US and Israel and the Gulf states, I think there's a lot of positive that can come of this in the region. But I understand why they're waiting. They need Israel to look strong. They need Israel to emerge as the victor. They need the US to emerge as the senior partner to Israel, having given it the direction and the weapons and the assistance and intelligence that it needed in order to ultimately prevail. Now, of course, Israel can do this on its own, but it'd be a shame to have the US sit out as this process begins to gain traction.
It seems to me that if other countries don't come in, and I see all the caveats, you're going to end up with more UNRWA-like and International Red Cross stuff that simply means people don't make progress in real capitalist, I shouldn't use that word, right? But real capitalist ways. I mean, there is the potential for productive stuff that could happen in the Gaza Strip, and it won't happen as long as UNRWA is handling the funds and UNRWA is handling what happens. So, as we come to the end of the program, people who have tuned in before know that I like to go out on a high note after all the depressing things that we have discussed. And you weren't as depressing as I thought you might be, but it's still possibly. Give us a high note so that we can say that we left with something nice to think about as we go and have our lunch.
Look, I mean, first of all, let's just, I think, acknowledge the fact that Israel, I just wrote this for a piece in Commentary, it's got its mojo back. When we look at the some of these daring operations, the pagers and the walkie-talkies and the targeted killings of top leaders, that's remarkable. Even the stroke of luck that led to the killing of Sinwar the other day, that was the result of Israel just sticking to its game plan, keeping its people patrolling in the Gaza Strip, staying in Rafah, by the way, right along the Philadelphia corridor. In other words, Israel has just stuck to its game plan. And even though there have been some very difficult times over the last 13 months or so, we are seeing an Israel prevail. And I think, by the way, the more we get deeper into this, you're going to see more operations that shock and awe and surprise, more along the lines of what we saw from the walkie-talkies and the pagers. These are the things that the Israelis have been saving up for exactly this moment. And so, you know, as I said in my piece for Commentary, don't call this a comeback. The Israelis have had these capabilities for a very long time, and we're now going to see them play out if this war continues. I hope that it doesn't. I hope that we find a quick an acceptable end to this conflict. Diplomatic solutions would always be better than more bloodshed and destruction. But if we have to go forward in this direction, I think the Israelis are going to continue to show everyone why they are the strongest and best and most agile military in the Middle East.
I'll take that. Jonathan Schanzer, thank you very much for a really enlightening trip around the region and some very, very important things for us to think about as we go forward. Thank you, and we look forward to having you again. Yeah?
My pleasure.